Hello and welcome to Save, a production of iHeartRadio and Stuff Media. I'm Annie Reese.
And I'm Lauren Vogelbaum. And today we've got probably our last interview from New Orleans.
Yes, it's only been over a year.
And in what we thought was a little bit of nice symmetry, it was actually the first interview that we did when we got into New Orleans, like mere minutes after we landed.
Yeah, I think I came straight from the airport.
You did,
I had all of my stuff with me, and it was a delight.
Oh, gosh, it was.
Yes, and also one of the people we interviewed, Liz Williams, she drove us home afterwards.
She did.
It was the kindest thing. It was so nice.
Oh, yeah, it was – okay, so that's Liz Williams, who is one of the founders of the Southern Food and Beverage Museum in New Orleans, which is also where we conducted the interview.
Yes.
She's also a president of the National Food and Beverage Foundation.
And she has many books to her name.
She does.
Yes. And we also got to sit down. This was a rare three-person interview.
Mm-hmm. Not including us, right?
Yes, not including us, with Chef Isaac Toops, who I bet a lot of you have heard of.
Mm-hmm, because he gets around on the television.
He does. He does indeed. I always see him. I'm always seeing him pop up doing stuff.
He was a Top Chef contestant back in the day.
Right. And he also is the owner of Toops Meadery and Toops South and NOLA. I wrote that down for myself. I didn't mean to say it out loud, but I just did, everyone.
You just did.
So sorry.
Yeah.
But it happened, and we can't go back now.
There's no going back,
no.
Only moving forward.
Oh, yes, exactly. And Isaac, yeah, he's been – recently he released another book called Chasing the Gator, Isaac Toops and the New Cajun Cooking, and a hot sauce line with two products, one called Smoky Green and the other Louisiana Liquid Snake, and they both sound delicious.
You were saying that there's dashi in one of them?
There's dashi in one of
them.
Oh, gosh. Uh-huh. And a new show on the Food Network called Kitchen Takeover.
That is so good.
Mm-hmm.
He was a very nice person, and I think that we've relayed the story before, or perhaps we've just reminisced about it to ourselves so many times that I've forgotten whether it was on air or not. But when we went to the Boudin Festival, mm-hmm. he had a booth there,
yes.
and he greeted us with great joy when he saw us coming up to the booth. It, like, held out a beer,
mm-hmm.
and we went to cheers him with the beers that we were already holding. And he was like, no, this is for you. You take it.
Yes. Pre-koozied beer.
Yes. It was already in a koozie.
Yes.
That's the kind of guy Isaac is.
Yes.
Oh, and the third person at this wonderful interview was Isaac's beverage director, Bryson Downham. He's also at Toops South.
Yes. So it was cool. We had sort of the baseline history and then a chef's perspective and
a beverage perspective.
A beverage perspective. And that we've definitely talked about how that is really key in what makes New Orleans, New Orleans, and the history,
mm-hmm.
which you'll hear about some in this interview. And yes, as we release this, Mardi Gras is this upcoming Tuesday. Mardi Gras 2020, because who knows, you could be listening to this.
Anytime. We can't control that.
No, that is beyond our control, in fact.
That's up to you.
Yes. So another reason we thought we would release these New Orleans interviews.
Yeah, absolutely. And if anyone listening to this is going to be in New Orleans for Mardi Gras or for later and at any time, really, I so completely recommend going to SOFAB, the Southern Food and Beverage Museum, because we didn't get to hang out that much that night, but they do cooking classes, and they have all of these beautiful, weird historical items. They've got a whole table of weird kitchen implements that you can play with, and they all look like torture devices.
They do. They do.
So much fun. And all of these old medicinal whiskey bottles back from Prohibition, probably, when it was sold as a medicine to mm-hmm. get around the laws.
Right.
Lots of stuff from Katrina and pre-Katrina. It's pretty wonderful.
Yes. And Toops Meadery and Toops South are also delicious. And the drinks are great. So.
Yes. And the location is right up attached to the museum. So
yes.
You can do both.
Very convenient.
Mm-hmm.
Very convenient. But okay, I think we're ready to get into the interview.
Let's do it.
I'm Isaac Toops, chef, owner of Toops Meadery and Toops South.
Bryson Downham, beverage director for the Toops restaurants.
And Liz Williams, the director of the Southern Food and Beverage Museum.
So we are in the Southern Food and Beverage Museum right now, surrounded by these lovely things. How did this happen? How did this place happen?
Well, we are 10 years old this year, which is really exciting.
Congratulations.
So a few years before we opened in 2008, group of us just decided that we needed to have a food museum in New Orleans. And we decided to make it regional as opposed to just about Louisiana, because there are influences that really cover the South. And so we started it. It was really very Judy Garland, Mickey Rooney-ish kind of, let's put on a show. We sat around the table and said, oh, let's just start a museum. And that's why it's such a surprise that we've been here for 10 years.
I can't thank you enough, by the way.
Yeah. And how did you guys get involved with the museum?
You know, there is a restaurant right connected to it that they had already put up, and it became available, and we straight up went, hey, Liz, can we rent the space out? And Liz went, sure. And it was literally something like that. We had got a bunch of attention through a bunch of things we did at Toops Meadery. We became acclaimed, and we got busy, and with a bunch of things coming to happen, we was like, hey, we should open up a second restaurant. And for better or for worse, there we are. So Toops South just made 2 years. So we're 2 years inside the 10 years. So we're all celebrating birthdays. Yay!
Yay!
You know, it's been a great collaboration. We feed each off other business, and we're just good neighbors. Or Liz is a good neighbor. I don't know if I'm a good neighbor. I can't speak for Liz.
He's a good neighbor, too.
Very political of you.
Well, I'm standing right here.
Could all y'all talk a little bit about those influences on Louisiana and specifically New Orleans cuisine? It is way more, it's a lot. It's. I know that that's a very big question. I apologize. How much time did you have?
So it's really the simplest way to think about it, although totally not with all the nuances, is that the three continents came together to form the basis for the cuisine. So you have America, Europe, and Africa. And our foods really reflect all of that. For example, our gumbo, we have three basic thickeners for gumbo. You have okra, which is African. You have filet, which is American. And you have roux, which is European. Now, you can use them all in one gumbo, or you use them separately, as that was traditionally, they were separate. And you would use them when this was in season or that was in season. For example, gumbo that is a seafood gumbo in New Orleans often has okra in it, and okra would be picked at the same time as shrimp and crabs were running, so it would make sense for you to use okra as a thickener for that gumbo. On the other hand, Native Americans would use a cup of filet in a pot of gumbo as their thickener. And all of our thickeners, which I think is really interesting, give flavor. Even the roux, which traditionally in a bechamel or whatever doesn't give a lot of flavor, it's just a thickener. But because our roux are toasted to the point where they are dark, they give flavor too. So that's a very simple thing. It doesn't talk about the Italians. It doesn't talk about the Filipinos. It doesn't talk about all the Vietnamese or all the other influences that we have. But that's the basic, you know, this is the way we got started.
What is filet specifically? That's one
ground
of those words.
Sassafras.
Yeah. It's something that gets tossed around a lot. It's, yeah.
And sassafras is a tree that is native to America. And so it wasn't something that anybody had ever seen before. I always thought it was ironic that Columbus came and found America because they was moving to find, you know, a passage to India for spices
for
and whatever.
Nutmeg, wasn't it? Yeah, I think
you know,
we just started. Yeah, sure,
all
sure,
those
the whole
things.
Thing, yeah.
And here you have this wonderful spice, which is filet, which nobody ever appreciated and took back. Because it was, you know, most of the spices people cared about, like allspice and cinnamon, those sorts of things, today we think of as like sweet spices, baking spices, even though I don't think they were always used that way originally. But somehow or other, it was overlooked that this wonderful seasoning of filet was not something that ever got picked up anywhere. I mean, even in America, it wasn't something that was that popular.
Right. Although it is creeping back into drink culture, yeah.
Well, I was just thinking about that. Sassafras, obviously used heavily in like root beer and other drinks. We we do make our own root beer here, and we take in all these local spices and herbs to bring that really unique flavor, which is a lot of fun, and it really gets you involved in what you're presenting and how you can best tweak it for the food and for the spirits and for the guest. Have you ever thought about doing a root beer gumbo?
No. No. And that's why I'm the chef, and you're the mixologist, sir.
Sassafras.
Let me tell you what I do. So for Thanksgiving, I baste the turkey with root beer, and it gives a really pretty glaze and everything, and then it gets into the bottom of the pan, so it winds up in your gravy. Mm-hmm. And then the next day, when I make a turkey bone gumbo out of all the leftovers and everything, and I stick the old gravy from the day before in or whatever, I usually then put filet in the gumbo because I want to cook, have it partnered with a root beer. And then I make a corn bit the night before, when I'm doing this stuff for Thanksgiving, I make extra cornbread dressing with oysters, and instead of potato salad or rice, I use that as the starch in the bowl of gumbo.
Nice. I'm actually giving Bryson a hard time. I've raised shortbread and root beer all the time. Just root beer and gumbo. Everybody's got a crazy new wave of doing gumbo. One recently with quinoa and kale. It was like, whoa, back up. I think Cajun food is very versatile and whatnot. And to speak on what Liz said, Everybody besides Native Americans were immigrants coming to South Louisiana. And what Cajun food is and what it was is still going to be a collaboration of different genres and different areas of land and location. And it still is today. And so when I say I do new Cajun, well, I'm doing new Cajun now, but it's going to continue to evolve because we continue to accept help and inspiration from everyone that wants to be down here in South Louisiana, one of the best places on the earth.
Heck yeah.
Chef's right, though. I can't cook. So
I don't know. Yeah. I actually don't know that.
It's true.
You haven't invited me over?
Cooking battle in the future.
Right.
And your family is Cajun, right?
Family is Cajun. We've been, father's side has been actually predated the Cajuns. And then we had married into Cajun. So Cajun background from my mother's side, and then from my father's side, from a Swiss family. Not Swiss Family Robinson, because I was just about to say that, but for 300 years. So we actually predate. So I'm about as Cajun as they get. Born and raised, as they say.
Are y'all from the area too?
No. I grew up all over the country. I've lived here longer than I've lived anywhere else. So first place I ever really feel like home. I think the food had a lot to do with that. Yeah.
And I was born here in New Orleans.
Oh, wow.
So I'm not Cajun. I'm a Creole.
That's all right.
And so I'm half Sicilian, which is a lot of Sicilian influence in the food in New Orleans. And then on the other side, on my father's side, my grandmother was French from before founding of the city of New Orleans, French, when they just left people in Natchitoches, and it was a fort. And then on my grandfather's side, my father's father, prisoners from Alabama.
Oh. Nice.
Yeah.
So many of the foods that are coming up, being so celebrated on a nationwide level from here, started as these sustenance foods, as these like whatever was in season and cheap and available. Could any of you guys speak to how they became this thing that's celebrated in the kind of in the white napkin restaurant industry?
All of our cooking traditions are rooted in what was necessity. So everything from the confiting of chicken and confiting of sausage that people would have to bury under their house for preservation. We put rice in boudin because they were a poor community and we needed to extend it to make a meal. We put sassafras or roux as a thickener in our gumbos and stews because we had to stretch those gravies and stretch those meals out. You had a lot of people to feed and not a lot of things to do it with. So curing, smoking, dehydrating, the things that we celebrate and do on purpose nowadays were actually just at a complete necessity. Doing the boucheries that they held were just simply to so everyone was able to butcher all the pigs all at once. And it was a community effort. We do them for fun nowadays, but back in the day, it was a necessity.
And I have, what he's saying is absolutely true, but I think that the reason there is a cuisine in Louisiana is because we actually had a French background, as opposed to what so much of America, new America had, which was English. So if you were an English colonist, you wanted to maintain your identity as an English person, so you wanted to eat like an English person. And there were actually settlements in the early days in America where people starved to death. And not because there wasn't food, but because they felt that the food of the savages was not the food that they would eat because they were too English. Whereas since we were French, we didn't have that attitude. And our attitude was, if it's here, it's French, because this is as much France as France. So if we have to eat an alligator, it's okay because it's a French alligator. And if we have to eat this other thing, it's okay because it's French and we're in France. And so that allowed us to just incorporate everything that we encountered here. And yes, we also were worried about waste and poverty and all of those things, but we weren't afraid to eat the food. And I think that makes a big difference.
We still celebrate our backgrounds. And I got one for you. In 1814, we took a little trip along with Colonel Jackson down the mighty Mississippi. We took a little bacon and we took a little beans, fought the bloody British in the town of New Orleans. Sorry, that song always comes up. Just gonna please my brain.
And that was when we actually became American, mm-hmm. as opposed to being French.
Right, yeah. How does all of this swirling culture influence the cocktail scene here is also a thing that's been influenced by it being a port town. And from what I understand, like, taxes were levied on liquor, and therefore everyone was like, drink more.
So in the early days, the city of New Orleans, whether it was French or Spanish governing, the money that was made by selling tavern licenses, which were auctioned to the highest bidder, and the taxes on the sale of liquor were what funded the city of New Orleans, the government of the city of New Orleans. So obviously, the more drinking you did, the better it was for the city.
Doing it for the city.
That's right.
That's why I do it.
It's civic duty. But that compounds itself into what Jeff was talking about earlier, out of necessity. Because in a lot of those early days, like around Spanish time and after, there were ways to get around paying a lot of those taxes and fees. For example, early to mid 1800s, you were allowed to serve spirits at a coffee shop or a coffee house. And the city of New Orleans had over 350 registered coffee houses. Now, I'm sure you don't believe that we were a big barista town at the time. One of those coffee houses, actually Sazerac Coffee House, that ended up creating Sazerac Cocktail and becoming one of the most famous cocktails in the country and in the world, was just a coffee house that had a close relationship with a French cognac distributor named Sazerac for Jaffee. So that all of that sort of ingenuity that we talk about in food bleeds over into cocktails. For the whole reason they turned it into a cocktail was because they couldn't get that cognac anymore, and they wanted to keep the name because they had recognition. So they changed up the recipe, added local bitters and a little sugar, and said, "Hey, this is now just called the Sazerac. Still, you should still come and drink it."
Oh, it's beautiful. How did Prohibition impact all of that? What did that do to?
You know, we have the reputation for being the wettest city in America during Prohibition. If you read anything about Prohibition or you watch documentaries or whatever, they're always about Chicago and New York. And that's because those were the two most violent places. Whereas other places, you had good citizens who decided not to sell alcohol anymore because it was against the law. In New Orleans, the good citizens, and that if you did that, now you had to bring in organized crime or somebody else to sell the alcohol because there was still the need for that. Whereas in New Orleans, the people who were selling alcohol before continued to sell alcohol afterwards because nobody really took it seriously. And there was not a city ordinance that made it against the law to sell alcohol, so the police didn't have to arrest you because it wasn't against a city ordinance. And Huey Long was the governor, and he decided that we didn't need a state law about it either. Now, there were many cities in Louisiana that did have such laws and parishes that adopted things on a parish-by-parish basis. But in Orleans Parish, which is New Orleans, it was only against the federal law. And so you had needed a fed to arrest you. And many, many doctors took advantage of the special dispensation for giving prescriptions for medicinal reasons. Over there, we have all these wonderful drinks that were sold for medicinal purposes only, very boldly marked on the labels. And at pharmacies, you could buy some kind of syrups that made your alcohol taste like gin or a martini or other things. So we were very weary of the law because we just didn't take it seriously. So can I tell the Izzy Einstein story? Yeah. Izzy Einstein was a fed, and it was his job as a federal agent enforcing the law to go from city to city and see how long it would take to get a drink in a particular town. And then they would know how many agents to send and all that sort of thing. He had a protocol, and it was that when he got into the taxi from wherever he was to go to his hotel, he would begin the timing. So he got into the taxi in New Orleans, he gave the taxi driver the name of his hotel, and then he started the clock. And he said to the taxi driver, "Do you know where a man can get a drink in this town?" And the taxi driver reached under a seat, pulled out a flask, passed it over his shoulder, and he said, "$5, please." So in less than a minute, Izzy had a drink in New Orleans. And this is not an apocryphal story. This really happened. You can read about it in the National Archives and all of that. It was, it showed that this taxi driver was so used to giving out liquor that he didn't even hesitate. He didn't worry about who was in his taxi cab or whatever. I mean, that just tells you how open it was that he could do that without even thinking twice.
Now, we didn't come out of Prohibition completely unscathed, though. You know, talk about those good citizens. They're one of the most famous saloon owners in New Orleans history. Henry Ramos, owner of the Ramos Bar and creator of the Ramos Gin Fizz, he was such a staunch supporter of temperance that he closed his bar out of respect.
Yeah, he believed in the law.
Yeah, he believed in the law, and he shuttered his doors and just said he'd never serve a drink again. And so they...
Very nation-like.
Yeah. Yeah. And they thought the recipe was lost until... one of the bartenders from the Sazerac Bar after Prohibition, like I think it was like 6 or 8 years after Prohibition, went over to his house and asked him if he would please share the recipe. And Henry was like, "Of course, I'm not keeping it a secret. It's right here." And it then got passed on. So
that was a personal decision.
Yeah, of course. No, yeah. No, he was an odd bird.
We have some more of our interview, but first we have a quick break for a word from our sponsor. And we're back. Thank you, sponsor. Let's get back into it.
Do y'all who grew up here have foods that's like specific like nostalgia points, like things that your family cooked that you either still cook today or that you do riffs on? And that, I mean, I said I singled them out, but you too, like you, foods can trigger nostalgia that you didn't technically grow up with. Like it can still remind you of it.
Yep. People ask me all the time, I get this question all the time, and it sounds almost cliche when I say it, but my favorite thing to do, favorite thing to cook is boil crawfish. And that steeps in tradition from what Liz said, you know, it's French because it's down here. And the Cajuns are very, like, what do you got? Well, let's just cook that. And everybody down here does that. Why do we, I get another question. Why do you guys use all that sugarcane rice and crawfish? That grows really well down here. Why wouldn't we? So, but boiling crawfish is great. So imagine this, you're in your shorts, you have a beer can in your hand, you have a hat, you're boiling 60 pounds of crawfish in a big giant pot, there's children running around, there's uncles telling jokes, there's women gossiping, there's naughty games being played, I'm sorry, they're inappropriately dangerous games being played, lies told, probably some music playing. It's a gathering of people, and I think that's what New Orleans and South Louisiana embraces a lot. Community gathering, having a good time, having a drink, cutting up a little bit, and not taking yourselves too seriously.
We are professional drinkers. Really, I mean that seriously. We learn how to drink from the time we're children, and you watch people drink, and you learn what the rules are and all that sort of thing. And so the amateurs are the ones who drink until they throw up all the time and all that kind of thing, so.
Yeah, also, we're professional drinkers. We will drink you under the table. Quite easily.
I wasn't going to challenge you.
Maybe after service.
Not today, yeah. Not during the interview, anyway.
Well, that sounds like fun, actually.
Right. Who made it through the podcast?
You've said, I like internet stalk to you guys a little bit. You've said that your grandmothers were both great influences on your cooking. What of your cooking is your family's, and like what is you've also trained in fine dining, and what of it is just yours?
You know, there's this one dish, and it was my grandmother Toops's redfish couvillon. Or she would use any fish she would catch. She would go catch the fish, clean the fish, make the broth, and then cook a giant pot of couvillon, a big Magnolite aluminum pot, and serve it with rice. And, you know, she would make her roux in the pot, and my grandmother on the other side would make her roux in the oven. So different dichotomies of Cajun cuisine. But that dish is on the menu from day one at Toops Meadery, and it's going to stay there. But, you know, with fine dining and your own additions, you kind of grow and develop. I wouldn't say I improved it, because that would be blasphemous in the Toops family, but I will say it's my own now. And you pick up things, and you use better ingredients, and you modernize your tactics. And I also serve it with crab fat fried rice, which is also something of my own creation. So grandma to grandma, you're gonna get different methods of cooking. Pass it down to the grandchildren. They're going to cook it different. That's a very Cajun thing to do. Everybody's gumbo is just a little bit different, and mine's no different.
I guess going back, time jumping around, going back to the drinking culture, how did New Orleans become the tourist attraction that it is, like the modern tourist, like bridesmaids parties and all the wackiness? How did that happen?
Has it just always been? Bourbon Street, like tourism, I want to say it started like in the late 70s, somewhere in there. I mean, we've always had a reputation for being a hard drinking city, you know, being able to drink on the streets and like all throughout the city, anywhere you want. It's always been a draw, but we just have always had the reputation of being a fun, laissez-faire, just a good time city. Like I said, I can't remember exactly when, but there was a time when Bourbon Street was more just for locals.
Certainly in the middle of the 20th century, Bourbon Street was much more a place where you would have burlesque. And we probably took burlesque farther than other places that had burlesque. But then after the sexual revolution, burlesque was not suggestive enough, you know? And so it got to the point where you couldn't do anything. You could find whatever you were looking for anywhere. And so New Orleans lost that kind of thing. But it used to be you'd go to a burlesque show, you you would get all dressed up and men and women would go, and it was definitely a show, you know. And it certainly isn't like that now. You know, the tradition of having, far, you know, coming for a wedding just because it's it's a tourist destination, or it's just a destination wedding or whatever. I mean, I think that's a phenomenon from the whole country. You know, you can go to a lot of places where you have that sort of thing. But the idea of coming to a place where you're going to get special music, like real food, because we have, we were always different. I think the city was always different. And we kept that difference. We didn't become as, not to say that we aren't American, but we didn't become as homogenized as other places. And the laissez-faire attitude that you talked about, I mean, that's, I can say, I'm 68, and so I remember stuff when I was a kid, and nobody ever thought about it. You know, when the silver person walks by on his unicycle and you're 6 years old, you don't go, oh, look at that. You know, it's just like, oh yeah, that's the guy, that's a silver guy on the unicycle, you know. And other stuff too that's a little bit more, less easy to talk about perhaps, but you just, nobody cares. And so I don't know why that is, but it's always been that way. There are people who speculate about the fact that as a really early, early city, we were totally unsupported by the French. They just were so infrequently visiting that we just went our own way. And since most of the people who were colonizing, if you want to call it that, were from debtors' prison, they were pickpockets, they were people who were just, you know, petty criminals, there was not a lot of respect for the ways, you know. Mm-hmm. And I'm not just talking about law, I'm talking about even mores and whatever. Mm-hmm. And so we just came to tolerate everything.
There's less of a focus on decorum and more of a respect for, like, tradition of families and like what our parents and their parents did, and it's been generations of people just having fun and being a little more social and involved and just enjoying each other's companies, each other's cultures. So like you said, we didn't get as homogenized as the rest of America, and the whole reason you can drink in the streets is because we didn't, that you could do that anywhere in America in the early 19th century, and then they started passing laws to make it illegal, and we never did that because
we were never that puritanical. I really think the Catholic background really made a big difference.
Oh,
because
sure.
We weren't puritanical, and of course the Catholics could do almost anything and then go to confession and they right were pure up. Again you know.
You can fly your freak flag in New Orleans, and that's completely okay as long as you get along with everybody else. You can be as freaky as you want.
Yeah, like we celebrated the Duck Lady and things like that, and everyone, I think it was a big article in the paper when she died because people were upset that the Duck Lady was gone. And it's just, you know.
Everyone in New Orleans, I think, is a socialite. We all care about each other and care about the community. And, you know, we're not so insular as, like, familial groups. Like, whole blocks will get together and support each other as families and friends. And I just haven't seen that, really, in many of the other places that I've lived. You know, neighborhoods mean something here. They really do. And that's, the pill plays a big role.
Speaking of homogenization, a lot of the rest of the country went through like the dark days of the 1980s and 90s in terms of cocktail culture. Did that not happen here? Or,
I mean, of course, in a way, yes. But because we did have that adherence to like our traditions, like, you know, drinks like the Sazerac and the Vieux Carré and the Gin Fizz, Bourbon Milk Punch, these things stayed strong because, you know, every Christmas, my grandparents would take me and my parents to the Sazerac bar, and they'd get gin fizzes, and we'd look at the lights in the lobby, and I want to do that like they did. You know, we'd go to brunch at Commander's or Brennan's whenever we could and get French 75s and milk punches. And it's just, it's less of a rejection of what came before. I think, I hear a lot about that, like the next generation rejecting what their parents drank because that's like old stodgy stuff.
Yeah.
And we just didn't really ever do that. You know, sure, there are lots of our Pat O'Brien's, for one example, did dive into that, that like kind of difficult, overly sweet cocktail thing, and you can still go get one there.
Sure, lots of Hurricanes by the, out of frozen machines.
They've got
Oh
no, it's better than that. They have a soda gun with a rake head, essentially, and it's got like 8 spouts on it, so he'll just, and the buttons are 1, 2, 3, 4, so however many he has to be. And that's cool,
not
and it's interesting.
Around.
No. No, I appreciate the creativeness there and also the entrepreneurial attitude. Like, they're doing it. You can still get a great Hurricane, a real great Hurricane at plenty of bars and restaurants.
Right.
But yeah, of course, the whole country wanted to drink overly sweet, sugary drinks. So we did too. But you could also get the really wonderful classics.
I also think that we still tend to be multi-generational in the way we do things. You take children, little children, to restaurants and they learn to do celebrations and how to be in a restaurant, and weddings are multi-generational, just what you're talking about, the crawfish boil and everything. And I think that helps a lot, and I think it in preserving culture, because people see it at different levels and they see it as it's celebrated and changes. And I think the tendency to have things that are like adult only this and adult only that, where you separate the children from the adults, then I don't think you have quite as much integration of the children into the culture. And we seem to have been able to let children be part of things always.
And if your family is here, you don't just go visit your great aunt on Easter. You know, you're going to go out to lunch with her. You're going to go see your grandparents. You're going to go, like, visit with your cousins and your mom and your dad on a much more regular basis than I think most people think. Like, oh, well, I've got to go, every 6 months. It's time to go see. It's time to go see grandma. But here it's like, your grandma's eating lunch at Galatoire's every Friday, and she's got an open seat this week. So, we are very multi-generational. Mm-hmm. And
we don't have family reunions, we make reservations.
That's right.
Mm-hmm. Oh, it's beautiful. We were, as we were lifting over here, our Lyft driver was a cook, was explaining that most people in town do cook and are terrific at cooking, but he does it professionally sometimes. But he was also saying that it's a relatively small city, like maybe about 500,000, something like that. But with such a huge tourism thing, is tourism a positive force? Do y'all enjoy sharing that kind of thing, all of this with people, or are there days where you're just like, oh, go home?
It's preferred to share. We want you to come over. We want you to experience. We want you to tell stories and have more people come over. That's where, come on down. If you like what you see, you like what you do, stay. It's a wonderful place to live. I'm never leaving. I'm not from New Orleans. I'm from a little town called Rain, Louisiana. I'm never going back. I've been on, not all over the world, but over half the world. I'm never going anywhere else. I mean, you might be able to tempt me in like one other city, maybe like Lyon, France, but that might be about it. We just do it so well down here that it's really a truly unique place. And I say that knowing I've been to other big cities.
It's that familial like host culture. And just because you're not from here doesn't mean you can't be a guest. That if you're not from here, that means you have more fun experiences to share with us and influences. So yeah, tourism is great.
And every time a new group of people moves in, like there's an immigrant movement of one kind or another, we are so happy to bring in that food and their ways and whatever, because that's a way to get to know people, is through their food. And then
if they do something you like, well, it's like, okay, that's fair game.
Boom.
Yes.
It's ours now. We'll give you props for it. We'll totally take your technology or your ingredients. Uh-huh. We love doing that.
Uh-huh. Well, that's what all of the cuisines here have done, right? I mean, like you were saying earlier, it's African and European and French uh-huh. and American uh-huh. all at the same time. French is part of Europe. I remember that.
Yes.
I
know
you got it. It tastes good. It's ours now.
Are there any Creole dishes that you had growing up that that have really stuck with you?
So one of the things, this is not really a dish, but it's something that my father did. And all through the time that everybody said you couldn't eat fat, you know, it's like my mother would say, you're not supposed to do that. And my father just didn't care. But he would, whatever he had, like if it was a pork chop or if it was a piece of steak or whatever, he always made sure that the piece that he bought at the grocery store had the biggest piece of fat on it that it would have. And then he would cook it, and so that the fat would be all rendered and all that sort of thing. And that was, of course, a really good part of it. And I can remember he would take a steak or whatever it was, and even if he had his piece, he would cut the fat off and cut that fat in half and give it to me.
Uh-huh.
And that was just, you know, so I love the fat.
I make a living off of it.
Speaking back to the culture of community and of celebration, you drive around the city, and I mean, y'all have all of these old above ground cemeteries. I mean, mostly from the water table, but and second lines and celebrations. Y'all make death a celebratory event rather than the puritanical concept of it. Does that affect, or how does that affect the food? How does that tie into the kind of food and drink?
We tend to celebrate life and not death. You know, let's remember what you were, not what you're becoming. Worm food. But no, you know, between the second lines and the big celebrations we have, we tend to, you know, let's look on the brighter side of things. The glass is half full, not half empty, and it's half full of whiskey.
Heck yeah.
Guys, do you have anything on the horizon that you're excited about? Anything in the future that you'd like to see New Orleans do more of?
What I really like going on right now is we keep expanding on the cuisines. Right now we have friends doing gourmet stoner food over at Turkey and the Wolf, and we have a South Asian food at Margie's Grill. I'm not just plugging my friends' restaurants. I actually go there and enjoy myself, but we keep pushing the borders, and we keep getting different ingredients and different techniques and expounding upon them. And I think that's just fantastic. We keep taking the influences in and keep putting them out our way. And I think that's what the future of the cuisine will be and will always will be. And we're at the forefront of that.
I absolutely underscore what he's saying, that not only with music, which is not, you know, we didn't draw a line and say, okay, up to here is historic jazz, and so everything has to stop now. We just have all of this music changing. Same thing is true about food. And I think that's actually what keeps it alive. It's not this dish or this dish or this dish. It's attitudes toward food and the enjoyment of it and all of that. You might have a particular thing in your family or whatever that you're doing, but even Isaac is talking about improving and changing and whatever as time goes by. And I think that that's what keeps it alive. It doesn't ossify as something that can't change. And that, as long as we can keep those attitudes, and it's the attitude as opposed to the specific dish that's important, then we'll continue to have this culture.
Yeah, that 300 years strong, we'll probably make it. I'd say the thing that's most exciting coming up in the future as far as drinks is, and it's been going on for a couple of years, is this changing attitude towards cocktails and drinking culture as we had it here before. It's fun. Drinks are fun. Like, it's not really serious business. You're having a good time. You're socializing. You're losing some inhibitions. And, you know, there's a lot of stodgy, like, especially in the beginning of this cocktail revolution that we've been having, there's a lot of, like, this is very serious. You don't, no laughing, no joking. Put down that Cosmo. But if it's good, then make it good and have fun with it. And you see a lot more bars and restaurants embracing that, like the enjoyment and the joy of it.
More joy, less fuss, I find in New Orleans, instead of other places that I won't name.
Yeah, and also the incorporation of different ingredients that haven't traditionally been thought of as drink ingredients, like more like savory things, and like thinking about it more as a dish, like a composed dish, than just a one note or even a nuanced cocktail that you only utilizes traditional things. Like we use a lot of salt and black pepper and other seasonings, cumin and whatnot, in cocktails here, and it's a lot of fun. It makes for a more unique experience with your drink, and that's definitely going on throughout the country. You see more and more like vegetable bases and things like that in your drinks, and I'm interested to see how far it goes and what people come up with as they begin to incorporate more and more non-traditional ingredients in drinks.
Do y'all cross coordinate your menu, your cocktail, and your food menus?
Yeah, we try to. We keep them within the season, and we're always bouncing ideas. Bryce is wonderful about accepting that I might tweak one of his cocktails at any point in time, but I do it with respect for his work. And it's more of getting together and bouncing ideas off the head than me telling him, no, I don't like this, do something else. It's more like, hey, why don't we try to add a pinch of salt to that, or try to squeeze a lemon in that? And it's that more that curiosity thing that gets bounced back and forth that I think makes our cocktail and our food game stronger.
He's right, and it is really good that we have more of that dynamic, because as I like to tell my bartenders whenever we're talking about cocktails, I don't like to be told no when it comes to an idea. Just a flat no is bad. You know, there's always merit in any idea. There could be something somewhere. So when I go to my bartenders or to chef and say, hey, I want to put creme de menthe and pineapple juice together with some rum and Thunderbird, some people's first instincts was to say, what are you doing? But chef and my staff are very good about being like,
said make me one.
Okay. Yeah.
that's my big make me one. Let me try.
Yeah.
I'll try drinking that. Yeah.
It's delicious.
It is. So, but that's a lot of fun, and I'm looking forward to seeing as more and more people and more and more bartenders and chefs get involved in making drinks, what they're gonna come up with.
Can I ask how you came to New Orleans and why you stayed here? And I guess you sort of said it's the first place I felt like home, but and how y'all met up?
I moved here when I was 18 to attend Tulane. I did graduate twice. That's usually people's first question. but I got involved in the restaurant industry at Commander's Palace in order to pay for living my last 2 years in school. And it was just so fascinating to me, the way the drinking culture existed and dining culture, because it was all brand new to me. And I got really, really fascinated by making drinks, because at the time I didn't really like the taste of alcohol, but I would have to try a cocktail and be impressed and think it was good. So I wanted to do this thing where I would take something that is literally poison and almost repulsive to the palate and craft it with my own hands into something that is beautiful and tasty. My degrees are in neuroscience, so the social aspect was also important, because I didn't want to be locked away in a lab with a bunch of very quiet people all day, and being at the bar and being in the restaurant.
You kind of did the opposite.
Yeah, total.
A bunch of loudmouths.
But now I get to manipulate people's brain chemistry in a much more hands-on fashion. So I still think that I am working within my field.
Isaac, when did you decide that you wanted cooking to be your career? Like, when were you like, this is my life?
I got into cooking. Well, I've been cooking my entire life. My mother and father, all my grandparents, everyone cooked. And that was a big influencer in how I was raised. I grew up cooking, but taking it professionally, no one in my family had ever done that. And I kind of fell into it, job hopping after my brief stint at college. I did not graduate. But I was job hopping and just kind of started cooking one day and fell immediately in love with it. And this was, I was 21, so it's kind of late in the cooking game as far as a lot of my contemporaries go. But I fell in love with it, and my wife wanted to move back to New Orleans. So we moved back to New Orleans, and I just walked into Emeralds Delmonico 18 years ago and was the fry cook and just kind of went my way up from there. So it's kind of been a whirlwind adventure from working for Chef Arnold 10 years to opening up my own restaurants to the second restaurant to being here to writing cookbooks and television and all this wacky, crazy stuff that it's modern day American chef.
And why food? Why a food museum?
So when I was in college, I was really interested in the intersection of food and culture. I never wanted to be a chef. I never wanted to own a restaurant, but I was just so interested in how things like the introduction of coffee into Europe changed European culture, of chocolate doing the same sort of thing, and how food and culture were so connected. But you couldn't study that when I was in school. And everyone kept trying to push me into home ec. And I could just, you know, see myself embroidering my way through college. And so I got a law degree, because that's what you do when you don't know what you want to do, you know. And so I was always interested in it, and I just did all these other things and got very involved in museums and putting museums together and said, all right, now's the time. I'm going to start a food museum. So there's not a linear way to describe that, that journey.
No. Does any museum have a linear like path to founding?
Probably right. Not. Yeah.
Can I ask you my nerd question about, because y'all do the charcuterie in-house stuff. Could you talk to me about your fermentation programs?
Our fermentation program just started, actually.
Oh, yeah.
Even though the meadery's been open 7 years, I chose to take a traditional route, the traditional Cajun route on the charcuterie, which is all freshly made and freshly prepared, because if you hang a sausage out in Cajun country, you're going to get a rotten sausage because we don't have the climate for it. We're way too humid. So we started the meadery and said, we'll do all the other things we naturally do, which is gratins or cracklins, candy or pork belly, riom, smoking, curing, confiting, fresh sausages, terrines, pâtés of that nature. So even though I have a lot of charcuterie, very little of it is actually fermented. And now that we're doing it, our ferments, Jason Lambert, my chef de cuisine in there, has a very regimented program of weighing, calculating, and each individual piece of charcuterie is weighed, tagged, and has its own individual name. We have Sparky in there. Sparky's a duck breast.
The naming is probably the most important.
Oh, yes. And
makes it tastier. Uh-huh.
Right? Yeah. I've never been so interested in both being introduced to and eating something at the same time.
The interview isn't over quite yet. We've got a little bit more for you, but first we've got one more quick break for a word from our sponsor. And we're back. Thank you, sponsor. And back to the interview.
You were kind of speaking to the intersection of culture and food, and I would say one of the things, apart from food and drink, that people think of when they think of New Orleans is jazz music or other types of art. Do you see maybe a relation between those things, or any kind of, does one inspire the other? Are they?
So I think that's a complex question. I think that musicians in this town cook, and the end of November, there's actually a conference in town that's all about improvisation, and they cover music, food, writing, theater, all sorts of things. And so they talk about how the city is full of improvisation and that people seem quite willing to do that. So to say that there's a connection between food and music, not only that, there's a connection between all of the arts, I think, in this town and all kinds of cultural things. But our musicians are often out there grilling something that they're going to serve while they're playing later, you know, and that kind of thing. And our magazines that are about music always have recipes of some musicians in that particular issue or whatever. So there's definitely an understanding that these things are connected. I think that there's a transmission of the music and of food also, which is similar, so that as people mix to make music together, they're also transmitting their ideas about food and all that kind of thing in the same way. So I think all of that is related.
The bar food culture is still alive. You know, there are plenty of places you can go early evening to get a drink, a little spread of food, complimentary, cooked by either the musicians that are performing that night or the bartenders or bar owners, or sometimes just regulars. And you go and you listen to music and you eat and you come together. So the musicians definitely, the food and drink and music all comes together.
And part of the professional drinking is that you actually have food with it, because that is an intelligent thing to do.
You don't have one without the other. That's it's not very proper.
Yeah.
It's much less fun.
Yeah, you got a wedding without alcohol? I ain't going.
Oh, I agree on that.
No.
I have to like
who does those?
Very much so to that wedding.
I mean, I'm willing to bring my own.
I was the minister at Bryson's wedding. I mean, he had it. I made him out of alcohol.
I have a great picture, actually, of one of my groomsmen passed out right there on that little...
Don't tell Liz that.
He's fine.
One thing that's come up a lot in this conversation is community and the community in New Orleans and around food specifically. And like every episode we've done on New Orleans food, there's some like asterisks of people were gathering and cooking this food. And I was wondering if what ways do you see the food and drink industry supporting this community that is New Orleans in times of hardship, or uplifting, or like moving the city forward?
I mean, we're definitely a big help each other out community. I mean, that was definitely, I hate to bring up Katrina, but it was one of those things that place shut down, everybody just started banding together. I mean, yeah, we had some looting and some horrible things going on. But afterward, you saw this big community embrace of let's just help each other out. Let's get our restaurants back open. Let's get back to something what we've seen before. Let's pass the bottle. Let's get everything out the freezer. Let's just cook it all. Let's just give it all away. Let's go help a friend patch up the roof. Let's get it done.
So after Hurricane Katrina, we did a special exhibit for the James Beard Foundation. The James Beard Foundation, the first time they had awards after Hurricane Katrina, was giving the collective chefs of New Orleans their humanitarian award that year. And they asked us to come up and do an exhibit about why the food was an important aspect of rebuilding the city. And one of the things that we concluded as we were doing our research and everything to do this exhibit was that, number one, chefs made their businesses open before their homes were repaired, because not so much because they were trying to have some kind of income, although I'm sure that there were elements of that, but because this became a place where you could come together with like people that shared some cultural thing, and that was this food. So we had a website that was operating in the aftermath of Hurricane Katrina, and we would get emails from people who said, I can't find filet, I'm in Minneapolis, you know, and I can't find coffee and chicory, and I'm in Seattle, or wherever they were. And where do you think I can get this, you know? And there was just this sense of missing their food, and that they were kind of out of place, because the food that they were eating wasn't highly seasoned, it was probably boring, and it was just not what they wanted or what they were used to. And so to come back and then have your food again and be eating it with other people who appreciated it and had missed it and were happy to have it. I think it really made the city come back and feel like it could come back, that this wouldn't be lost. And it's almost impossible to explain. I mean, the city is a place where it's no longer true because people have actually been born here again. But when people came back to New Orleans, everybody chose to come back to New Orleans. So it became a city where people chose to live. And it wasn't just because you were born here that you lived here. You chose to live here. And the food, when you're mucking out your house and ripping out sheetrock, you don't have a kitchen. It doesn't function. So are you going to make a peanut butter and jelly sandwich? Are you going to go to this restaurant that's opened itself so that you, even if you're eating off of paper plates and things because water wasn't potable or whatever, you're happy to do that. And that meant, like, this is still a real place. And I think that the food and the chefs who opened their restaurants and made the food available were just the most remarkable thing. I mean, all the first responders, all that kind of stuff, all great, and I'm not taking away from them. But from a cultural standpoint, that meant you were in New Orleans.
That really fueled the rebuilding. Yeah, because mm-hmm. even if nothing else was recognizable, you could still get some recognizable food. Mm-hmm.
I wanted to ask. It sounds like you guys have spent a few minutes in here. Do y'all have a favorite object in the museum?
Favorite object in the museum. We had this wonderful. I mean, I'm not sure what kind of stone it is, but it's. It looks like it's marble or granite. One of the absinthe pourers.
Oh yeah.
One of those with the angels on it.
Uh-huh.
It looks so cool. If it ever goes missing, I didn't take it. but I'm one of the few people that actually like the taste of absinthe and Pernod and those flavors. I love that intense licorice herbal flavor, and it's my favorite because I want to use it one day and like wait for my birthday, if it's okay, Liz, to have it out and come have the ice water set up drip into off the sugar into the absinthe and salute to all my friends. I'm gonna do that one day.
Tomorrow
we're treat up tomorrow.
Okay, all right.
What's your favorite? My favorite item in here?
Yeah.
So there's actually a lot of great answers to that, but I'm going to go with one of the weirder ones. There's a blown up picture of Al Copeland over there. You can't see it from in here because it's facing the street. But it's young, like handsome Al. And I swear, few people agree with me, but I swear he looks just like Hugh Jackman. And he's got three like fried chicken drumsticks in between his fingers like this. And it's just like New Orleans Wolverine, and I love it.
There's also a 10-foot hurricane.
Yeah,
with the drink.
You can't, but there's, you can't drink it.
Right, no, you can't drink that. No.
It came in a box labeled T-Rex or dinosaur or something like that.
Nebuchadnezzar.
Right.
Drink it if you tried hard enough. It would take some doing.
Right. So I change my mind all the time because it's like whatever just came in is like my absolute favorite thing. As a group of things, I love our gadgets. I love to watch people play with the gadgets, and we'll take a turned over milk carton and let children stand on it so that they can play with the gadgets. And to me, just watching people play with everything and say, what do you think this is? And try to guess what things are. That's my absolute favorite thing.
And do y'all have favorite things on the menu?
Ooh, I'm biased, but I'll say what came to mind, the cracklins that we do. They're the best this side of Atchafalaya Basin, and maybe the best in Christendom. But once again, I'm very biased. So if you don't know out there, a cracklin is basically the better part of a chicharrón. So a chicharrón would just be crispy skin, where a proper fried cracklin is skin, meat, and fat. And we toss them in our own special crack spice. Yeah, we just get the drug references out there. And we fry them fresh to order, and I make the joke, but it's not a joke, that they put my children through school. It's not a joke. I sell that much that it pays for their schooling. My kids live off of pork fat.
So do many politicians' kids.
Yeah, right.
obviously, I lean towards the drinks. Chef took my favorite dish off the menu, so we're gonna leave
that. What was that?
The Farm Eggs in Purgatory.
Oh, man.
That was great.
Sorry.
It's okay. I don't even like breakfast. And obviously our drinks are changing all the time. But right now I would say my favorite is something we're doing for happy hour. And this goes back to like New Orleans traditions that just won't die. We're doing setups, which traditionally would just be like a 20 mil hip bottle of liquor, whatever you want, a bucket of ice, and 20 ounces of soda. So we're doing our own sodas that we talked about, root beer earlier. So we have the house-made root beer, which is great, really nice. We have a spiced Coke, like a cola, which is cool. But my favorite right now is a sesame cream soda. It's lemon and vanilla and toasted sesame, and we mix that with like some rum or some gin or whatever you're feeling at the time, and you just have this beautiful, bright, effervescent drink that you can pour for yourself and your friends, and it's a social experience, it's a drink experience, and it's a weird, fun flavor, and I love things that are a little out there.
It tastes like one of my favorite candies. It's not a Chico stick, but it's a little of the sesame candies that are so delicious, and it tastes just like the alcohol version of that. So it's like, thanks for alcoholing up my childhood. I didn't need the help.
My favorite thing on the menu is the hamburger.
Yeah?
I could eat the hamburger every day.
Thank you.
Is that a general statement about hamburgers, or is it a specific statement about this
It's a specific statement about this hamburger. I couldn't eat hamburgers every day, but this hamburger I could.
We take our burgers seriously, just like every other menu item. You know, it's everybody's like, "Oh yeah, a good burger." No, a good burger is not just something you can just shuffle out there. It's something that takes time, and you got to cook it properly every time. And we grind our own meat. You got to make sure the bun is toasted. Make sure the sauce on it contains all of the bun. Make sure you bite into it. You get equal parts bread and bun. Horrible part about eating a burger, biting into it, it's all bread the first bite. Screw that. Screw you to have that burger.
And I will encourage people to get a hamburger, and when they order it medium, I just tell them that they can't have it.
She's right.
And people do it because they're used to not having good meat on their burger, so they get it medium so it's cooked. And I tell them, you don't need to do that. Just eat it the way you're supposed to eat it, and it'll be juicy and delicious and everything. And then if they say, no, I want it medium, I don't let them get it.
Like, stop the waiter, go like...
Yeah. I tell them, you can't have it. You have to have it this way.
Yeah, just get the chicken sandwich. It's cooked through.
Yes, exactly. There are other good things. If you can't eat the burger the right way, don't eat it.
Dylan, I know you're like doing a job over there. Do you have anything you want to ask these fine people?
What do you see for the future of the museum? Anything in the plans that excites you?
Well, we have two things that we're working on that are going to be for 2019. So we want to add a Missouri exhibit. We've actually had people from Missouri, and actually a restaurant in Missouri had people sign a petition that we add Missouri to the Southern Food and Beverage Museum. So there's that, and we're literally working on that. But also, we're also looking at putting in a Puerto Rico exhibit, because where else would you put it? I mean, it would have to be here. In a bigger sense, we're opening our yard, and we're going to have an outdoor cooking space, and so we have all kinds of things that are in the works for 2019. So I have other future things too, but we'll just talk about one year.
Are your kids into cooking?
My kids actually love to cook. They have short attention spans like their father. But they love to come in and see what they're doing. They don't always want to eat when I'm cooking. And I think I'm a normal parent trying to get their kids to eat more vegetables and eat new foods. And they'll make They'll make leaps and bounds and then like backstep three or four times. They won't eat a hamburger, but they'll eat sashimi. They're weird kids. Yeah. So they love to come help. And my 7-year-old has her first knife. She got it when she was 6. And it's razor sharp. And she uses it even though I'm always sweating. She's not cut herself. But that's how you learn in the Toops family. You here's a knife. You'll figure it out. You cut yourself sooner or later. My little one, Ivy, she's 4. So you give her a bowl with some chips and a spoon. She crushed the chips. Not necessary for any reason. It's just we'll have chip crumbs later. But, you know, they love something to do. It's like, Dad, just give me something to do. And give them something to do when they're pleased as punch. And you just set them on the counter. Don't touch that. Don't touch that. Don't touch that. Ow, that's hot. Yeah, that's how you learn.
Oh, yeah.
My son loves to help at the bar. So he'll come in and like I'll take him back there after service and he'll make sodas for me and my wife. So like I'll get him some juices or some shrubs or syrups and he'll pick out what he wants and then he'll shake it up. We started doing that because he had watched me work for a while and one day he was eating breakfast and he had a juice box and milk.
Oh no.
And he came running into the living room and he handed me the cup and he said, Daddy, I want you to try my drink. I made milk juice. And my wife was like, I was about to throw it away and I took it and I drank it. And I was like, it was actually pretty nice. You know, and like I said, I don't like being told no when it comes to mixing flavors. So I couldn't bring myself to tell him no. So milk juice is my son's first recipe. And now, since then, he's made a few really interesting sodas. But yeah, it's, you know, get him
milk
involved.
Juice. Yeah, I like it. Mm-hmm.
Coming soon to a menu near you?
Sure. Sounds like brunch.
Yeah, that's the brunch name.
Milk juice, brandy. Brandy milk juice. Brandy milk juice.
Brandy milk juice.
There it is.
I'll have to tell John Michael.
My cookbook just came out, Chasing the Gator. Selfless promotion. Available on Amazon.com. Autograph for free at both my restaurants.
That's a good one.
That's it. You can come see us at Toops Meadery in Toops South. What's the address? The Meadery? It's 845 North Carrollton at Meadery. And South is located inside the Southern Food and Beverage Museum. Awesome museum that you can get a cocktail from the bar and walk around with, and you can also have a bite.
Yes. Shouldn't visit one without the other.
Should not visit one without the other. In fact, it's mandatory.
Yeah. Yeah.
Mm.
Yeah.
No, anything else.
Yeah. You're like, no, that's it. I've talked forever.
he got the book thing.
Yeah. Pretty much morally obligated.
That brings us to the end of possibly one of our final interviews. It brings us to the end of potentially our last New Orleans interview that we'll release.
Potentially.
You never know.
You never know what's going to happen. It's true.
We might unearth something else, some spaghetti ghost, but like interview form. And we hope that you enjoyed it as much as we did. It really was wonderful.
Oh, gosh, yeah. So,
like the only time we got a random singing in an interview, I believe.
I think so.
It's definitely one of few. If it's happened again, pretty rare.
Yes, absolutely.
Yes. And if you're going to New Orleans for Mardi Gras, have fun. Be safe.
Mm-hmm.
But have fun.
Yes.
Yes. And we would love to hear from any of you listeners out there, any of your Mardi Gras shenanigans or fun times or foods or drinks, all of it.
Yeah, or non-Mardi Gras related.
Oh, yeah. We're pretty open.
We're pretty open to shenanigans, yeah.
We do like a good shenanigan. You can email those to hello@saverpod.com.
Or reach out on social media. You can find us on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram @SaverPod. And we do hope to hear from you. Saver is a production of iHeartRadio and Stuff Media. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, you can visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows. Thanks, as always, to our super producers, Dylan Fagan and Andrew Howard. Thanks to you for listening. And we hope that lots more good things are coming your way.